This episode of the Tech Central podcast is brought to you by Pinnacle, Africa's top ICT distribution business, delivering the exceptional every time. I'm Duncan MacLeod, and you're listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm really super excited about this next interview. I'm in Pretoria today to have a conversation with Major General Charles Bowden, the administrator or the former administrator of NASA, the U.S. National Aeronautics and Space Administration. He was the administrator from 2009 until his retirement last year. Major General Bowden is a 1968 graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, a retired U.S. Marine Corps Major General, and a former U.S. astronaut. He was involved in four space flights and spent more than 680 hours in space. He piloted both the Space Shuttle Columbia and the Space Shuttle Discovery. It is a real pleasure to welcome you to the Tech Central podcast.
It's quite a pleasure to be here. Thanks very much.
You just delivered a wonderful lecture at the CSIR here in Pretoria. I know you have visited, you mentioned you visited South Africa on previous occasions, but what's the purpose of your current tour to the country?
I'm actually here this time as a representative of the U.S. State Department, acting in the role of a U.S. State Department science envoy for space. And the for space part was added sort of after I was added to the group of four or five of us that are on this 12-month journey, because my background is actually space exploration and human space flight. And so It gave the State Department an opportunity to have somebody go out who could talk about potential for collaboration and cooperation with the U.S. in areas that where the space agency works, where NASA works.
And you're also fostering interest in the field of science and space
travel.
Well,
hopefully I'm doing that. That remains to be seen. So
you're talking to school kids and hopefully getting them excited.
We have tried, we started, as I mentioned, this will be a 12-month journey for me, and we started out 2 months ago, actually, by having a trip to the Middle East. So we went to UAE and Jordan. And then we came back home for about a week or two, and we're here now. We came here from Ethiopia, so we were up in Ethiopia for about 4 days, mostly in Addis Ababa, and then down here, spent the first few days over in Cape Town, and now here in Pretoria and Johannesburg before we head back to the U.S.
So if we can, let's have a brief look at your fascinating career. You went to the U.S. Naval Academy. You joined the Marine Corps and became an astronaut, but as you mentioned in your presentation this morning, you didn't actually want to do any of those things.
No, I didn't want to do any of those things.
How did it happen?
It was, I tell students, please don't follow my example, or at least don't follow my path, because mine was a windy one, full of confusion, to be quite honest. I went to the Naval Academy just because I fell in love with the school through a television program. For really very shallow reasons, the uniform, the women coming to the campus, all other kinds of things. And when I got there, it was a pretty intense environment. And the good thing for me was my very first year, my freshman year, or plebe year, as they call it, my company officer, the commissioned officer who is responsible for the care and feeding of the 150 or so midshipmen in my division of the academy, my company, was a young Marine Corps major by the name of Major John Riley Love. And he was really tough, but unbelievably fair, and became sort of an inspiration to me. He was very much like my dad, and my dad is my ultimate role model and hero. And so 4 years later, when it was time to graduate, he was long gone. But I look back on what I had done and what I liked and didn't like, and although I felt I could do almost anything, I decided I wanted to be like him. I didn't pick the Marine Corps because I wanted to be a Marine, which is probably fault, but I picked it because I wanted to be like him. So it was a great example of how we as human beings, we as individuals, really influence young people that look at us or look to us and want to be like us. And so everybody should think about that as you, you kind of go through life. As far as once I decided to accept my commission in the Marine Corps, I thought I wanted to be an infantry officer. And then I got to find out what infantry officers really did, and I found out I really didn't like crawling around in the mud a lot. And infantry officers spend a lot of time in the mud. My wife was not enamored with me becoming an infantry officer, nor was my dad or my mom or anybody in my family. And my wife just kept harping about going to this place called Pensacola, Florida, where the Navy's flight school was. And I resisted as long as I could, and then finally I gave up. And we took off and went to Pensacola. I had an aviation option coming out of the Naval Academy, and I did very well in the basic school, where we learned to be a rifle platoon commander. And so when I asked to go to flight school, I ended up going to flight school. And I worked really hard, so I was usually, if not number one in my class, I was toward the top, because I learned very early on that if you wanted to get the things you wanted, at least going through training, they usually brought you in order of class standing. So I wanted to go fly jets, and I knew specifically which airplane I wanted to fly by the time I got through basic flight training. I had learned about the A-6 Intruder, which was an all-weather attack aircraft, two people in it, and it had a tremendous mission. You flew at very low altitudes, at very high speed at night, and in all the weather, and so that's what I thought I wanted to do. And I applied to go to the A-6 program, and that's where I got sent, because I got my first choice. And I ended up in a place called Cherry Point, North Carolina, went through A-6 training and became a pilot, and then had an absolutely tremendous early career in the Marine Corps. That's what took me to Vietnam, and, you know, we lived in Thailand but flew mostly in Vietnam. And then came back to the States and recruited for a while for the Marine Corps before finally getting accepted to go to test pilot school. And you may say, how in the world did you decide going from not wanting to fly to wanting to be a test pilot? One of my primary flight instructors, when I was going through the last phases of my flight training, and I had fallen in love with flying, was another Marine, Major Pete Field, who was a test pilot. And we talked about the excitement, but the challenge of being a test pilot, how demanding it was, and how precise you had to fly. You know, it's none of this scarf hanging out the window and that kind of stuff, but precision flying and following a checklist and everything. And again, because I had chosen the A-6 for that very same reason, I decided, what the heck, I want to be a test pilot. And so it took me a number of years. I think I applied for 5 or 6 years before I finally got accepted to test pilot school. And went back there and did that. And the one remaining thing was this astronaut thing. I had no interest in it, none whatsoever, growing up. I knew what astronauts were. I admired them and everything. But coming out of the segregated South, I just didn't see that was something I was going to be able to do. And I didn't want to ask. I was afraid that if I asked, I'd be told no. Mm. And so I let other people put an artificial limit. I put an artificial limitation on myself, which was a lesson I learned when I met the late Dr. Ron McNair, who was another African-American who had grown up about 42 miles from me in a much smaller city than mine, but he had always wanted to be an astronaut. And he had taught himself calculus, taught himself physics, gone off to college, done superbly both at the undergraduate and graduate level, and earned a PhD in laser physics, became one of the foremost laser physicists. And so, quite naturally, he was accepted when he applied for the very first space shuttle group. And I had a chance to meet him years later when he came to Pax River, where I was working. And we were talking and exchanging ideas about, you know, being a test pilot and about what he was doing as an astronaut. And he asked me if I was going to apply for the space program. I told him, not on your life. And he looked at me real strange, and then he asked me, why not? I said, you know, they'll never pick me. And he said, that's the dumbest thing I ever heard. How do you know if you don't ask? So he essentially embarrassed me into picking up my pen and paper and applying for the space program. And I ended up going to interview in Houston and getting selected for input into NASA's second group of space shuttle astronauts.
Great. Well, I want to come back and talk about your astronautic career, if that's the correct word. But you related a great tale during your presentation this morning about getting accepted back in the 1960s into the U.S. Naval Academy. A great story of persistence and overcoming prejudice in the system as an African-American.
Yeah.
You eventually wrote a letter to the president at the time, Lyndon B. Johnson, asking to be accepted into the academy, and it worked.
Yeah. It did work. I, growing up in the segregated South, when I applied for an appointment, you had to go through your congressional delegation. So every kid was eligible for an appointment from one of the two state senators from his back then it was only his, congressional representative. And then everyone was eligible for a vice presidential appointment. And so I was really counting, since the congressmen and senators had told me, no way, they were not appointing a black to go to the Naval Academy. Then I wrote to the vice president. I had been talking to him for a couple of years, and then when President Kennedy was assassinated in my senior year, all hope of going to the Naval Academy for me kind of vanished because I did not know the incoming vice president and I wasn't eligible for a presidential appointment. But that's why I said I kind of remembered a little bit of what Ron had said or what my mom and dad had said, and I just picked up the pen and paper and wrote and said, hey, I want to go to the Naval Academy. Mm-hmm. You told me you would help, and you're no longer the vice president, but can you help me as the president? And never heard from him, but I got a visit a couple of days later from a Navy recruiter. And then even later, President Johnson, who had become president at the death of assassination of President Kennedy, he sent a retired federal judge around the country looking for qualified young black and Hispanic men that could go to the U.S. service academies. And so between those two sources, I ended up getting an appointment from Congressman William Dawson in Chicago, Illinois, and I struck off to the Naval Academy. So that's how I got there. After getting there, that's another story because I found out it was really hard. You could say unfair because it was just ripe with racial discrimination and the like because the South was still segregated and Maryland was a Southern state. Mm-hmm. And although the yard itself was integrated with the midshipmen, once you left the gate and you went out into the town, you were back in a segregated town again. And so I would cry every weekend and tell my mom and dad I wanted to come home, and they wouldn't let me. My father would say, look, hang in there one more week. And I did.
So let's jump forward again. Yeah. 1980, I think it was.
Yeah.
What went through your head when you got that call from NASA that you had been selected?
Wow. After not having even considered applying for the space program and then meeting Ron and being embarrassed into doing it, I had done my interview in February, and then months passed, and it wasn't until the end of May, my wife's birthday, as a matter of fact, May 31st, 1980, the phone rang as I was in my flight gear and I was walking out to fly a test flight. And the duty officer called and said, hey, there's a phone call for you from somebody in Houston, Texas. And so I turned around and I went back in and took the phone, and it was a Mr. George Abbey, who was actually the director of flight crew operations. So he was responsible for all American astronauts, the selection and care and feeding. And so I had been told before I left down there that, you know, if Mr. Abbey calls, there's a good chance you got selected. If he doesn't call, you didn't get selected. Trust me. And so it was George Abbey on the phone. So I knew I had a chance. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, he asked me if I still wanted to come to Houston. I told him, certainly. And then I asked him, how soon did I have to be there? He said, yeah, don't rush. You know, just take your time because don't talk about it. Don't tell anybody except maybe your wife, because we've got to get the press release out and we don't want it to go out prematurely before we've notified everybody. So I did. And a couple of days later, the announcement was made. So, you know, we had people swarming all over wanting to talk to this person that was getting ready to go be an American astronaut. But it was unbelievable when I got the call. I was, like I said, on my way out to fly a test hop. And I couldn't turn around and go back because they had told me don't tell anybody. And so I went out and flew my test hop. But it was not the normal test flight. It was as soon as I closed the cockpit, I was screaming and yelling and with joy. And I took off and went out into the training area and did my test. I finished all my test cards and everything and came back in and landed and went home and broke the news to my wife.
Mm-hmm. What did she say?
She was reserved because she had, you know, she had really encouraged me to apply. And when I went down and interviewed and I came back and my first words to her were, you know, this was one of the most phenomenal things I've ever done. I was really impressed with everything down in Houston at the Johnson Space Center. I loved all the people. I thought the astronauts were incredible, but there is no way we're going to get selected to go do this. I mean, we're talking about really smart people who have done all kinds of things. And so she remained encouraging, but I kind of forgot about it. Months passed, and then finally her birthday, May 31st, I got this phone call. And when I went home that night and told her, she was kind of like, well, of course you did. You know, I knew all along you were going to get selected. But anyway, we set about, you know, finishing the school year with our kids and then packing up the house and moving to Houston, Texas. So mm-hmm. we were all really excited. My kids were very young at the time. My son was going into fourth grade. Our daughter was in pre-kindergarten, as a matter of fact. So they really couldn't comprehend the fact that their dad was was moving them halfway across the country to start training to be an astronaut. They had no idea what an astronaut was because we had never talked about it. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your career as mm-hmm. an astronaut. You ventured into space four times. Mm-hmm. What would you say was the absolute highlight of those missions?
You know, that's hard to say. There are highlights all over the place from each of the four missions. It goes without saying that watching Hubble on my second flight, when we finally got Hubble in its deploy configuration and it was ready to go, which was a story in and of itself because nothing went right on the day we were trying to mm-hmm. deploy the Hubble Space Telescope. But when we finally got it into its correct position and released it, that was sort of... it was like dreamy because we didn't know exactly what Hubble was going to do, but we all on the crew felt that it was going to lead to just absolutely phenomenal changing information for humanity. And it turned out to do that. So, you know, watching this thing drift away was just unbelievable to mm-hmm. me. Then, you know, I flew three more flights or two more after Hubble. And each in its own way was very special, but probably the one that was the most special from a standpoint of feelings and emotions was my very last flight. And that was STS-60, which was the first joint Russian-American mission where we actually flew with a Russian cosmonaut. So that one was special for a lot of different reasons. It was, you know, I had been trained as a Marine. You know, I did not have any desire to work with the Russians. And when my superiors called me in one day in Washington, D.C., where I was working, and said, hey, we want you to go back to Houston and fly again, I was excited. But then I asked them, okay, what was the mission? They told me we were going to fly a Russian cosmonaut. I told them right away, I said, stop. You know, you got the wrong guy. I'm not flying with any Russian. You know, I trained all my life to kill them, and they did the same for me, and I'm just not going to do it. And they calmed me down. They preached a little tolerance and a little patience. And I went to dinner with them that night, and we hit it off instantly. They both had young kids like I did. All three of us talked about, you know, our visions for the future and what we wanted the world to be like for our kids. And so the discussion most of the night revolved around our children and our families. And so I went in the next morning and I said, hey, I'm all in. You know, I think I can do this. And as I said, we had brought a couple of hundred people over from Moscow. And so they moved into the neighborhoods and we worked with them and tried to help them adapt to life in America. And it turned out to be just an incredible experience.
Did you communicate in English? Or?
We communicated in English most of the time. A couple of the crew members started taking Russian language and did pretty well at it. The others of us were just inept at learning any kind of language. You know, had a hard enough time with English. So learning Russian was not going to be not in my bailiwick, not that year anyway.
So I have to ask, what was it like looking back on the Earth for the first time from space?
It was, for me, it was a highly emotional experience. And I tell people all the time, I thought I was thoroughly prepared technically to go to space. My training team could not have done any better, you know, in exposing us to things that can go wrong in the vehicle, to helping us know how to respond if something went wrong. So from a technical perspective, I was really ready to go fly. I wasn't ready emotionally. Mm-hmm. And I found that out pretty quickly because going to space on the shuttle, any spacecraft today, you know, you kind of lay on your back for a while you're waiting for the engineers and the technicians to work their way through the countdown. And then the next thing you know, the vehicle's lifting off and you're just shaking to beat the band. And you're worried a little bit, but after the first 2 minutes, the solid rocket boosters separate, and it begins to get really smooth. And then after 8.5 minutes, you're in orbit. You're going around Earth at about 17,500 miles an hour. And for us, on my first crew, that meant we were going around Earth once every 90 minutes. So we got to see a sunrise and a sunset every 45 minutes, and every Earth rise was absolutely incredible. And
what are the emotions that went through your mind?
What happened for me, it's about 10 to 15 minutes from the time you lift off until you've reached your orbital velocity, that 17,500 miles an hour I mentioned, and the main engine's cut off, everything, you're just kind of floating through space for now until you get to a point where you're going to fire up the engines again and try to get yourself into the desired circular orbit that we wanted to be in. So, but for me, I looked out the window several minutes into the flight. I mean minutes, not hours, minutes. And I saw this island coming up, and it looked strange, but I figured, okay, as we get closer, I'll figure it out. And as we got closer, I realized it wasn't an island at all. It was the continent of Africa. And then the first emotional thing hit when I looked, and because I'm black and I'm African American heritage, I started looking for the cities on the west coast of Africa because I really wanted to be able to identify where my ancestors, from where they had come. And the more I looked, the more I realized there are no borders, there are no boundaries, everything just runs together. And I was stricken by that to the point that I just kind of tears started coming out of my eyes. And that was, I tell people, that was my first transformation in terms of what spaceflight does to change your perspective of the planet. All of a sudden, we lived on this planet that has no borders or boundaries the way that we've been led to believe or the way that we grow up believing. That was tremendous to find that. And the other thing was, in spite of the fact that there were no borders or boundaries, and I couldn't tell, you know, which countries were which, I also couldn't tell that human beings were down here. In the daytime, the ground just blends in. So you can see colors, without a doubt, but there, you don't see buildings, you don't see large structures. Things that you can see are like roads, bridges, runways, long linear features. And so, once again, I was just taken aback by the beauty of the African continent. And the beauty as it stretched from the Mediterranean coast through the Sahara Desert and all the way down to the Cape of Good Hope, while not having any evidence that people were there because you couldn't see the cities in the daylight and you didn't see any borders around the city. So I tell people a lot, I said, boy, if I were from Mars coming to Earth, I'd get to about where we were when we deployed the Hubble Space Telescope, about 600 kilometers above Earth, and I'd put the brakes on, and I would say, okay, no sense in going down there. That's just it's a pretty planet, but there's no life because you just don't see that life. And the feeling of insignificance lay pretty heavy on me because, you know, I'd grown up thinking that we were it. I mean, human beings, we're the only thing that matters. And you started looking back at the planet, recognizing, no, there are a few other things like our environment. When you look at specific things, you looked at when it got night, you could see the beautiful lights on the ground in inhabited areas or very rich areas. And you saw how in the poor areas, it was still dark. You know, it was there was no light. No street lights, no anything like that. And so, again, you realize that, man, we've got to do something to bring about a fairer planet, to make sure that people get a fair shake no matter where they come from or the color of their skin or anything else.
I must say, I think it was when I was a kid watching Carl Sagan's TV show where he had that episode about the pale blue dot.
Exactly.
That really brought home just how insignificant we were in the scale of the universe. Yeah. It's unbelievable. So I know this is a broad question, but what, in your view, is the most important work that NASA is involved in today?
Ooh, that is a broad question. But I actually believe, in spite of the fact, all the excitement about Mars and human exploration and the like, I think some of the most important work that NASA is involved in today is the continuation of their just unbelievable questioning about our environment. Trying to understand our own planet and, you know, supporting the life support program or the Earth Science program, that is noble work. And it's work that is, in my mind, generally totally unappreciated by the non-scientific community, especially unappreciated by our politicians who make the ultimate decisions about how we're going to use what we learn and how we're going to protect this planet. How are we going to keep ourselves from destroying Earth and needing an alternative place to go? Mm. Yeah.
It was clear from your presentation this morning that you're passionate about finding life elsewhere, the possibility of finding life elsewhere in the universe.
Yeah.
What do you think is the likelihood of us finding microbial life on Mars? And what about elsewhere in our solar system?
I think the chances of finding microbial life on Mars is excellent, to be quite honest. Again, I'm not a scientist or an engineer, and I've not done personal research. But when you look at things that we've seen since we started putting satellites around Mars back in the 2070s or in the 1970s, you know, we've got some orbiting platforms, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, MAVEN, which is looking at Mars's atmosphere, a new satellite that's from India that's called MOM. It's the Mars Orbiter mission, which is looking at India's lower atmosphere. And then we're going to put some studies from South Africa, hopefully, in space, and they'll help us understand more about the mid-atmosphere. So I think it's the work that NASA does in Earth science to provide data to decision makers around the world that's among the most important that we do.
And how profound will it be if we find, even if it's microbial life?
I was asked by a student, you may have heard during my formal presentation earlier, why do we care? You know, what? That wasn't his question, but it was essentially, you know, why do we do this? So why do we need to go study Mars?
What's the profit motive, I think he asked.
And there is no profit motive. Mm. There is the motive for people like me and people in NASA, other people in NASA and like here in CSIR is, or CSIR, the motive is protection of the species, making life better for people here on Earth. And so if we find that there is some living organism on Mars or in the oceans of Europa or somewhere else, you know, we can look at them and we can determine what kind of life did they experience or are they experiencing, to hope that we can find signs of diseases that may have impacted their earlier civilization that we can ward off because we now know it exists or could exist. You look at places like Mars because you'd like to be able to see that Mars did in fact look like Earth and existed in many, many ways like Earth, that it had vegetation and life and all that other kind of stuff. So I think that'll be very important to learn also.
And it'll tell us that the universe is teeming with
life. It'll tell us that the universe is probably teeming with more of that. You know, it won't definitively say it because, as you know, we are somewhat reluctant to, you know, to go very far in any claims or anything.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Something that's always intrigued me, though, and I'd be very keen to get your view on it. If the universe is teeming with intelligent life, why have we never heard it? Why have we not heard their radio communications?
Good question. And that's what makes you wonder, is the world teeming with intelligent life? Or is the world teeming with life? And in my estimation, it is more important to find life of any kind, in any shape, rather than you know, constantly be pursuing intelligent life. We may never find that. But if we can find life of any kind, that will allow us, again, like I said, to study the history of the planet, the people who came before us, and help us to understand how we avoid the pitfalls, if you will, of a study that you know, just we gotta know more. So I think that's the big thing.
I am unfortunately being told that we are out of time.
We've got to go, huh?
This has been a real thrill for me, and I have no doubt for our listeners as well. Major General Charles Bowden is a former astronaut and NASA administrator from 2009 until last year. Thank you so much for talking to Tech Central.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so very much. Your questions have been great.
Thank you.
Thank you.